Welcome to Defining Moments, a program in which we get to know prominent people personally as they share the significant events, insights, relationships, and values of their lives. Defining Moments is brought to you on Christian Talk 660 by American Leprosy Missions, an international Christian ministry headquartered in Greenville, South Carolina. Defining Moments aims to build up the body of Christ by making its leaders better known to all of us. And now, here's your host for Defining Moments, Bob Smith.
Welcome to Defining Moments. Thanks for joining us. Today we'll get to know Reed Lehman, President and CEO of Miracle Hill Ministries in Greenville, South Carolina. We're in the northwest corner, called the Upstate, of South Carolina. Reed, thank you very much for telling us about your life today. We're looking forward to learning more about you, and we really appreciate your time.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Bob.
Defining Moments is about your life, of course, but first, tell us a bit about Miracle Hill Ministries.
Miracle Hill is a collection of ministries that connects those who care with people who desperately need to know that someone cares. Our motto is, if you cannot find a friend in the world, you can find one here. And we have homeless shelters in Greenville, Spartanburg, and Cherokee counties. We have children's shelters in Greenville and Pickens counties. And on any given night, about 400 men, women, and children are staying in our care.
And Shepherd's Gate is one of those, right?
That's right. It's a women's shelter here in Greenville with 62 beds for women. And we've been Shepherd's Gate has been operational since 1993.
And when was Miracle Hill started?
1937, in the midst of the Depression. It started as a soup kitchen. And then in the 1950s, we added a home for unwed mothers and the rescue mission, later the children's home, and have continued adding ministries ever since.
Are you affiliated with a denomination or a school or anything else?
We're unashamedly evangelical and Christian, but no, we're non-denominational. And we're pleased that both in our support and our staff, we draw from a wide spectrum across Christianity.
So your support comes from contributions?
Right? Contributions. Churches provide about 10% of our contributions. Individuals provide the bulk of it. Some give annually, some give monthly. If you'd like to know more about Miracle Hill, you can see our website at miraclehill.org.
What size staff do you have?
About 150 members of staff and about 500 active volunteers at any given time. And we believe that the volunteers replace maybe 20 to 30 staff members we'd have to hire if we did not have the volunteers.
Great. Well, it's a wonderful ministry, and it's one of the most important ones in this community, in this state, and the entire region. We'll be asking you more about it later. Well, I have some good news for you, Reed. You've been given a fully paid sabbatical for as long as it takes to write your autobiography. Now, I know you've already written God Wears His Own Watch, which is autobiographical in many respects, but it has gaps, as you say, personal gaps, and we'd like you to fill those in. So we're going to send you to this comfortable, beautiful, but very remote mountain cabin we call Scribbler's Den. It has a cook and a housekeeper, but no TV, telephone, email, or internet. It has a word processing computer with dictation software and a printer, and plenty of pens and paper if you want to write that way. Think you can stand to be away for all your demands for a little while?
I'd love to do that, Bob. Writing is one of my passions, and going away to write would be thrilling.
Okay, well, to help you get ready to do this writing, we're going to ask you to recall the defining moments of your life. By that, we mean those events, insights, people, decisions, mistakes maybe that have shaped you, changed your direction, have helped you and attracted you, maybe been your best accomplishments, whatever you feel. But you can't write all the time, of course, so you'll want to take some of your favorite books, perhaps recordings of some type. And best of all, you can have two visitors from the past. We would like to know who you would choose and what you'd want to talk about with them. This sound like a good few days?
Sounds terrific.
Well, we all have one defining moment in common, our birth. Tell us about yours, when and where, your parents, and so on.
I was born in the old St. Francis Hospital in Greenville. My father came to Greenville to prepare for to be a missionary in New Guinea. He was going to become a farmer missionary, and he began working at Miracle Hill temporarily while he was in college, and never felt they could spare him. He stayed on for 10 years and took over in 1965, and he was still serving there as his death in 1985. His dad was a prosperous Indiana farmer, and he loved God, but he came down to see my father in those early years and went home and told his farmer friends, I thought my son could do better than that, better than the primitive conditions, better than living in poverty, better than having passion, but not very much in the way of facilities.
Oh, I see. Do you have brothers and sisters?
I'm the oldest of five. I have three younger sisters, and then the youngest of the family is my brother, Jim. A sister who's a florist in Williamsburg, an accountant in Panama City, Florida, a musician up in Wisconsin, and then my brother's an attorney in Columbia.
Big family. Your earliest memory or your favorite early memory, what would that be?
I was a pretty active little boy. My earliest memory is sticking the broom in the hen side of the door on the old trailer mobile home where my parents lived during college and slamming the door on it, which sprung the hinges. Soon after, we moved up to the farmhouse at what is now Miracle Hill Children's Home. And my parents never needed a dustpan because when they swept the floor, the crumbs would fall through the cracks in the floor and the chickens would pick them up underneath. I remember my mom went off for a while, and while she was gone, I brought the billy goat in the house. And when he began leaving droppings in the living room, I had locked him in the bathroom. So mom came home, she heard a noise in the back bathroom and opened the door, and this little bearded face peered around at her, and I think she screamed after that.
Well, was there any next defining moment before you started to school?
I just remember how tight things were. My parents were unpaid. They lived on campus at the children's home, and they ate whatever food was given. I came home from preschool one day, and I was hungry. And all we had in the house was a loaf of bread and some mustard, so I had mustard sandwiches. And not too long after that, the director was coming for supper, and Mom said, I could pick the menu, and we could have anything we wanted. And I picked hot dogs because it was just the most exotic food I'd ever seen.
So where did you start to school?
I went through all 12 grades at the on-campus school at the time at Miracle Hill Children's Home. We no longer have a school there, but for years we had our own school there on campus.
And what size school was it?
Well, we had 160 children in care at our peak. So with staff kids and a few from the community, maybe 2 to 250 at any given time.
Wow. But that made fairly small class sizes then over 12 grades. Huh?
It made fairly small class sizes, and one of the benefits of that is so many of the kids were way behind in school, so they could get a lot of individual help from the teachers. One of the challenges for me is, though, I wasn't behind in school, so I sometimes was waiting on the people around me to catch up, and they'd be out in the hall worried that they were going to fail their test, and I would act like I was worried that I had failed my test as well, and I knew that I hadn't.
Do you remember any favorite subjects, activities, teachers during that time?
I was an avid reader. I read every book I could get my hands on. It's about the way I spent almost all of my time out of school and too much of my time in school. I would get in trouble for reading in class. But I read every book I could that seemed interesting in the library, all the boys' books first. I read Treasure Island by Robert Louis Stevenson. I read The Hardy Boys. I remember Treasure Island scared me so bad that I hid it under the bed, and it was weeks before I could go back to finish it. But after I read all the boys' books, I began reading Nancy Drew, and after a while I was reduced to romances. I was just desperate for something to read.
Well, did you play sports?
We really didn't have sports there at Miracle Hill. We had a good work program, and everyone was physically fit because of hard work. I ran some, but we didn't have basketball or football or anything like that.
How about musical instruments or singing?
There was a salesman with Liberty Life Insurance named Wallace Case, and he came to teach band at Miracle Hill Children's Home as a volunteer, and he would find his instruments, and I played the baritone for him and his band, and later the sousaphone. We also had a Miracle Hill Children's Choir that went out to sing in supporting churches, and in the grade school, or in my grade school years, and then later again in my high school years, I would go out with a choir. I wanted to be a bass in high school, but I never could pull it off.
What would you say is your next defining moment?
Well, a strong defining moment for me was when I was about 11 years old. My father was the director of the ministry, and we just lived on what people gave us. The food would be whatever had been given recently. We lived one summer on frog legs, one summer on rhubarb. And I started the summer with a very open mind about frog legs, but I couldn't stand them by the end of the summer. I still love rhubarb today. But the staff were determined that the kids would have milk at every meal, and that was one thing that we normally had to buy. Pet Dairy would give us some, but they sold us the rest, and they required us to be caught up completely on a regular basis. I think it's probably once a quarter. One quarter ended, and we needed about $750 to pay the milk bill, and we didn't have it. There was nobody we could get it from. Miracle Hill was deeply behind and in debt when my father took over. And the staff were praying about it, but felt sort of helpless, and we just had come to the very last day at which the bill could be paid. About 4 o'clock that afternoon, someone who worked in a nearby textile mill came to see my father. He was a young man in his 20s. He had lint and cotton dust in his hair and on his clothing. And Dad greeted him, and he didn't give his name. He just sat down and began to cry. And while he cried, he pulled out his wallet and began counting out $20 bills. He counted out $700 in $20 bills, and then another $50 in $10 bills. And then he quit crying, put his wallet away, and began to leave. And my father said, "Can you tell me what's going on? What did you just do?" He said, "I've been saving money to buy a car, and God told me I had to bring you $750 today. He said the children needed it." And then he got out, got up, he walked away, and we never saw him again. He wouldn't take a receipt. We never got his name. He wouldn't give it. He just had come to deliver the exact amount of money that was needed. And I think not only that, but a number of similar situations when I was a child taught me that God would supply our needs, that there was a real God, and that he really cared about us.
And how old were you when this happened?
11.
11 years old. My, what a wonderful thing. Well, Scribbler's Den has a player for every kind of audio or video recording. Will you want to take any recordings with you, music or anything?
Bob, I'm a little bit of an introvert. I enjoy solitude and eliminate noise whenever I can. I may listen to a little classical music sometimes in the car, but I really am a person of words, so I'll probably take, I may take some episodes of Monk to watch while I'm winding, but if I take anything at all, I'll take lots of books, books that are good for me, and then novels just to pass the time.
Okay. We'll let you take books instead of recordings then. Let's take a short break now. We love our sponsor, and their message is vitally important. When we come back, we'll talk about a book you'll take to Scribbler's Den, more about your early work and how you became a Christian.
When my mother and father saw that I had leprosy, they said, "You have to leave our home. You have a terrible disease, and if you don't leave, many others will get sick."
This is Shamily Beka. She is 12 years old. She knows that what leprosy has done to others, it can also do to her. Leprosy begins by destroying the sense of touch in the limbs. Without feeling, a person easily injures their hands and feet. Paralyzing deformities often appear. As the years go by, sunken noses further deform the face. Shamily is beginning the fight of her life.
I was very young when I got leprosy, so I know how terrible it is. Look at my hands. Look at my face. If I could wish for anything, it would be that no child would ever suffer this, that every child will be cured of leprosy. That is my prayer.
Leprosy still strikes over 500,000 people a year, many of them children. The cure for leprosy is 3 little pills taken for 6 months or longer until the leprosy bacilli are destroyed. The average cost to cure a person of leprosy is only $20 a month for 1 year, or $240. But most people with leprosy, like Shamily, live in poverty. They simply can't afford the cure. Thousands hope to receive the cure before leprosy destroys their faces, hands, and feet. That's why your help now is so important. Call now and say you'll provide the cure for a person like Shamily. Call American Leprosy Missions at 1-800-543-3131. Your gift is tax deductible. Please call now. 1-800-543-3131.
Hello, I'm Chris Doyle, President of American Leprosy Missions. We are proud to sponsor this exciting new radio program, Defining Moments. For over 100 years, ALM has been working to bring healing and hope to those affected by leprosy. Leprosy is a tragic disease that robs people of their dignity, usefulness, and self-worth. but you can make a difference, a defining moment, if you will, in the life of someone with leprosy. Help us deliver the cure. Call us today at 1-800-LEPROSY or visit our website at leprosy.org. Thanks for listening and for caring.
Welcome back to Defining Moments. We're talking with Reed Lehman, President and CEO of Miracle Hill Ministries in Greenville, South Carolina. Tell us about the middle school years. What was life like at that time?
Well, I was still in school at the children's home, and it was almost a self-contained environment. I knew very little of what happened outside of the campus there. My father loved God, and he was active in serving the Lord, and he loved our family. But because of the difficulty Miracle Hill was in when he took over, the financial straits, he was gone most of the time. I really didn't feel like I had a father in the middle school years. My mother did a great job investing in the lives of her five children, and I knew my father cared. He just wasn't there.
Did that change as you grew older?
It didn't change much for me. I loved my father, still do love him, even though he's gone to heaven. But we never really did very much together as father and son.
What was your next defining moment then before high school?
I think it was two men that God brought to sort of take the place of my father. One was a fellow named Ray Hodges. He was a staff member in our maintenance department. And he began pointing out how good I seemed to be at solving problems and encouraged me to solve more problems. He would give me a difficult situation in maintenance and ask me what I would do about it. And he took me off and taught me how to shoot a gun. He taught me how to use tools and to repair things. He felt like a father when I really needed one. There was another guy named Don Hummel, and he was a teacher in the middle school. And I remember one fall night, he brought one of my classmates and I to spend the night with him. And we watched a TV show together. We ate popcorn. He taught us about personal hygiene. From Don, I caught a hunger for learning. Don subscribed to Time magazine, but it wasn't just that. He just loved to learn, to read, to study. And he lit a fire in me that's never been extinguished.
Well, the Lord provided what you needed in male mentoring, didn't he?
He did.
A Scribbler's Den has a small library, the Bible in Hebrew, Greek, and every English translation, and basic reference books, concordances, and dictionaries, and Encyclopedia Britannica. But you can take other books, and you said you want to take several. What's the most important one that you'd take?
My favorite author is C.S. Lewis. I've read all of his books, but I might take them all again and read them over. My favorite of his books probably is Mere Christianity. I've given it away to a number of individuals. I've read it a couple of times myself and probably will read it again soon.
Yes, many of us have given it away. It's a wonderful thing. So what about the high school years? What were your favorite subjects and arts and foreign languages and so on? Any girlfriends and so on?
Starting in high school, I always did seem to have girlfriends. And I began dating my wife, Barbara, then. She came from a broken family when she was in the 9th grade and I was in the 11th grade. We dated for a while at Miracle Hill and then went our separate ways and only to meet up again later in college, when I was in college. I took French. I took writing and began a passion for writing. I really enjoyed that probably more than anything else in high school. Took French briefly as a foreign language in high school.
All right. Well, tell us about your next defining moment.
I think there were two relating to fear that occurred during high school. So many of the children would not sing in the assemblies or chapels or church services, and I really wanted to fit in with them, and I would often stand beside them and not sing myself. And one day I began thinking and realized I love singing, and in my effort to fit in, I'm not singing. Do I really care that much about what they think of me? And I just began belting it out and singing as loud as I wanted to, and I didn't worry about that anymore. I also really enjoyed solitude and walking in the woods and walking down in the swamp, and I remember one day after exploring the swamp, I was coming back to the children's home across a large overgrown field. The grass was up past my knees, and I was afraid of a copperhead. I didn't want to get bit, or a water moccasin. And as I was walking across the field, I would look really carefully before I would take a step. And finally, after taking 10 minutes to cross maybe 25 feet, I realized it was going to take me a long time to get home. But secondly, I realized that even if I was bit by a snake, I probably wouldn't die. And God controlled whether or not I got bit or not. Why worry about it? So I just began striding confidently off against the field, not worrying about whether there were any snakes down there that I couldn't see. And not only did it get me home sooner, but I think it really freed me up inside. It helped release me from some of the fear that had bound me before.
Hmm. So that's changed your attitude about risk and difficult situations ever since, huh?
In a lot of situations, yes.
Right. Did those other kids start to sing in those services after you did?
Some of them did, but even for those who didn't, I don't think I felt rejection or I was thinking they would reject me, but they didn't actually reject me.
Right. So often the case, isn't it? How did you come to give your life to Christ?
Well, it's a bad thing to say in a program like this. I'm not even sure. I know that I was saved at about the age of 6, and as other people have done who were saved that early, throughout my teenage years, there'd be quite a number of times I'd go back to God and say, God, in case I wasn't saved before, I want to accept you now. But from my earliest memories, I was committed to Christ. I wanted to please him. And from my teenage years on, I wanted to serve him.
Often when people like I did accept him at such a young age, we look back and wonder, did we really have a conviction of sin? Do you think you did back at age 6?
I don't know if I did.
But you certainly did later. Whenever as a teenager you recommitted,
I certainly did later, and I almost wonder if the point of salvation doesn't really come at the point at which you understand what your other choices are. And then you choose God anyway. And I know that as a teenager, I understood in that regard. I don't know if I understood that at the age of 6.
Did you go to college as soon as you finished high school?
I did. I was initially a humanities major at Bob Jones University. And then when I found out I'd have to take a second semester of biology, I switched my major to business so I wouldn't have to do that. But business was a love for me, and I was minored in English so that I could take all the writing classes that I could take.
Well, that served you well, both the business and the writing, hasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Now, Scribbler's Den has an amazing device called the Flux Capacitor. We bought it from the producers of the movie Back to the Future. Did you happen to see that movie?
I did.
Yeah. Well, that device allows time travel in both directions. So you're allowed 2 all-day visitors from the past or the future, if you know anyone there, and they can stay from mid-morning through dinner. Nice long visit. There's just one blackout period, AD 0 to 100. So who will be your first visitor, and tell us why you've chosen him or her?
My first visitor will be Daniel. He was taken from his family as a youth. He lived in a completely pagan society. And yet several times in Scripture, God identifies him as one of the most godly, most spiritual people that God ever observed. And I would love to know how he was able to balance the demands of the pagan culture in which he lived, in which he was a political leader, along with his commitment to Christ, and how he found the balance that allowed him to be true to Jesus Christ, not Jesus Christ, but to God and to his worship of God.
We'll take another break for our sponsor now, and after it, we'll hear about your family and the next book you'll take and how your career progressed.
You're listening to Defining Moments on Christian Talk 660, serving upstate South Carolina from Greenville, Spartanburg, and Anderson.
Hello, I'm Chris Doyle, the president of American Leprosy Missions. Although people in the West do not often encounter leprosy, it is still a common disease in Asia. Let me tell you a moving story. Garud touches people with leprosy every day in West Bengal, India. He isn't afraid. He used to be one of them. Carefully dressing a leprosy patient's wounds, Garud remembers back to a time when he suffered greatly and needed someone to help. He found out that he had the disease when he was just 9 years old. Garud's family lived in poverty, and he had no means to pay for treatment. With his condition quickly deteriorating, Garud met a local church pastor who told him about the power and salvation of Jesus. But he only sneered at the pastor. His family fervently worshiped the traditional gods of their village, and he didn't believe Jesus could make a difference in his life. Several years passed, and Garud was on his deathbed. The leprosy had become so bad it was about to take his life. And it was when he was at his weakest that Garud remembered the words of the pastor who told him how Jesus had healed many people with leprosy. Jesus can heal my sickness, Garud repeated to himself, and a new faith developed in his heart. He had a defining moment. With tears in his eyes, he prayed and asked the Lord for forgiveness. Miraculously, the Lord completely healed Giroud of his leprosy in only 2 weeks. Giroud dedicated his life to serving Jesus, and soon he entered Bible college to prepare for future ministry. After graduation, Giroud began serving as a native missionary, reaching out to those with whom he could most relate, the leprosy patients. Today, he goes around his village helping those with leprosy by cleaning and dressing their wounds. Their eyes light up as he cares for them and touches their disease-stricken bodies. Deeply moved by his acts of kindness, they desire to know the source of his incredible love, and he shares with him his amazing testimony. Many of the leprosy patients have received Jesus as their Savior, and as a result, Giroud now leads a Christian fellowship, and more than 80 children are attending Sunday school classes he started in the leprosy colony. You can be a defining moment in the life of someone with leprosy. Call ALM today at 1-800-LEPROSY or go to our website at leprosy.org. Thanks for caring.
Welcome back to Defining Moments. We're talking with Reed Lehman, President and CEO of Miracle Hill Ministries in Greenville, South Carolina. So you married Barbara. Tell us about how you got back together and tell us a bit about her.
As I mentioned, Barbara went home for her senior year of high school. And about 3 years later, she came back to serve as a dorm mother for little children at the children's home. It was the summer just before my junior college year. And I was absolutely fascinated by her. We began dating. We became engaged that fall, and we married just before my senior year of college. I loved her energy, her enthusiasm, her personality. She was an amazing athlete. But I knew that I was supposed to serve God at Miracle Hill, or at least I believed that I was supposed to serve God there. And Barbara also was willing to spend her life that way. That sort of confirmed it for me, that I was supposed to make a life with her.
So did you have children?
We have two. Matthew was born in 1979. He almost raised himself. He was just, when he got older, we realized that we hadn't been as successful at sharing our values as we were with Andy, who was born in 1981, and he was very high maintenance. But he, because we were always butting heads, he connected more easily with her values. Today, both boys are grown, of course. They live in their own homes in Simpsonville. Neither are married. Both love God, and they're active in their church, and Matt got back recently from a 2-year stint in Guatemala in the Peace Corps.
The Peace Corps, how did he come to be in the Peace Corps?
I think it may have had something to do with growing up around homeless people and going to live as a homeless person with me when he was 13. We did a 5-day stint as a way of celebrating his coming into manhood.
Did he enjoy that time in Guatemala?
He did enjoy it. He came back as a fluent Spanish speaker. And it was an amazing time of growth for him, and I think that he was very useful and a blessing to the people down there.
I'm sure he was. What's the next book you will take to Scribbler's Den, and why is it significant?
You may have noticed that Alexander Solzhenitsyn died recently.
Yes.
I love his writing, and I'll probably take the Gulag Archipelago and reread that. He writes so insightfully into the human condition. He can get into the mind of the oppressors and those that are oppressed, and he's painfully honest in terms of the thought process he goes through as he records both his own experiences and even in the fiction that he writes.
Well, you really are a reader if you can get completely through that. It's a very detailed book with lots of stories and numbers and all that sort of thing, isn't it?
It is such
a powerful book. What was your first job after your education, and why did you choose it?
I grew up working at Miracle Hill Children's Home. I was over all the lawns on campus as a high school student, working with other children there in the children's home. In college, I worked there and ran the maintenance department up through about 5 months after graduation. I really felt called to serve there.
And you've worked there ever since?
No, actually, because I married the wrong woman, I had to leave Miracle Hill. And that's maybe one of my next defining moments. Just after graduation from college, my wife and I began to find ourselves in constant conflict, and all of it seemed to center around our presence at Miracle Hill. I don't know if maybe there were some insecurities on her part, and maybe there was some blindness on my part. Certainly there was some blindness on my part. But I realized that if I was going to save my marriage, I would have to give up my ministry. And I was so puzzled that God had allowed me to marry the wrong person. But I knew that my first call was to my marriage. And I made the commitment to find a job outside of Miracle Hill. In fact, I asked the recruiter that I asked to help find me work to find me one outside of South Carolina. And I made a commitment that once I walked away, I would never look back, that my commitment would be to my wife. 3 years later, Barbara asked if we could go back to Miracle Hill. And I had never envisioned going back. That 3 years in the business world when I worked with 84 Lumber Company was the best education I ever got in my life. I had been completely in a Christian environment all of my life until that point. And in the business world, I found out how much the business world demanded of people for nothing more than money. And so often in Christian ministry, people had asked very little of themselves. They were working for low wages, perhaps. They were working under hard conditions. But their standards often in terms of work accomplishment and personal discipline were often very low. And so that education was incredible in my life. And Barbara then suggested we go back. God, I think, put the conflict between us to take me away. And God could not have spoken to me at the time to convince me to do that any other way.
Mm. So that time in the business world must have prepared you well for the presidency and the tasks of management and administration in the ministry.
I feel like it provided a lot of help, and it gave me a different perspective. When I left Miracle Hill, we were segregated. We thought that if we ever tried to integrate, that there would be riots and there would be all kinds of problems. When, after 3 years in the business world, I was horrified by what I saw as normal when I left. And one of my first tasks coming back was to change that and to fully integrate the ministry and to move us away from sort of the monastery approach to one that was fully integrated with the community around us.
You've written at least one book that I know of, God Wears His Own Watch. You consider yourself an active writer? And if so, tell us about your other work.
I'm currently actually on a short sabbatical. I'm writing my second book, and it's about fighting fair, working in a healthy way with conflict in the context of marriage. So I have some other book ideas that I want to pursue, so I really do enjoy writing.
Good. Well, tell us a little bit about God Wears His Own Watch.
Well, many of our listeners have heard of George Mueller. He was a man in England in the 1800s who cared for orphans through the power of prayer. And while I'm certainly not George Mueller, a lot of the stories in this book are similar to the ones he told, in that we talk about a great need that only God can meet within the context of ministry and sometimes in the context of our family. And God showed up. George Mueller's case, he always showed up just at the right time. In my case, it seems like he was often late, but he was never too late. It always worked out. So I'm sure I'm not as spiritual as Mr. Mueller, but I have had the privilege of seeing God at work a number of times.
And so it is about the history of his working in your life and in Miracle Hill.
Yes, it is.
Great. What was your next defining moment after you came back to Miracle Hill?
I worked with my father for 5 years. And when my father died in 1985 of liver cancer, I took over the ministry. When you take over from your dad, everyone assumes you're probably incompetent. I don't know whether or not I proved them wrong. But I do remember how troubled and distressed I was as my father was dying, trying to step into his shoes. He had been a great man of faith. And he had been the primary fundraiser, and for 5 years I had been sort of the business manager and worked with our industrial thrift stores and helped with organizational parts, but I really didn't really know anything about fundraising. After Dad was too sick to be active in any way, we needed about $8,000 1 week for payroll taxes. And they were due on Thursday. On Monday morning, I really didn't know what to do, but I knew that if Dad was around, he would have a prayer meeting. So I had a staff prayer meeting. And we told God what we needed and asked him for the $8,000. And on Tuesday, we eagerly checked the mail, and it wasn't there. And we had another prayer meeting, and it didn't come on Tuesday. And Wednesday, we checked the mail, and it wasn't there. And we had another prayer meeting. And Thursday, we had a prayer meeting in the morning, and it didn't come in the mail that day. And we had a prayer meeting at noon and checked the mail again that afternoon, and it didn't come. The $8,000 that we had to have by 2 o'clock did not show up. I think we borrowed some from the bank quickly and paid the payroll taxes, but I was completely defeated. I realized that I wasn't spiritual enough to leave the ministry and that it was probably going to stop with my father's death because I couldn't sustain it. And we had an on-campus church at the time at the children's home, And my father and the director of the children's home, Mr. Halford, would take turns speaking on Sunday mornings. This Sunday was my turn to speak, and I had nothing to say. But as I was studying for the Sunday message on Saturday, I was reading in Psalm chapter 34, in verses 4 and 5, and there's a verse that says, "And they looked unto him and were radiant, and their faces shall never be ashamed." And somehow God broke through. I was so ashamed that I hadn't been able to do whatever needed to be done to raise that money. And God broke through and told me I never needed to be ashamed. All I had to do was do what I could, and he was responsible for the rest. And joyfully, I shared those verses on Sunday morning. And joyfully, we went to Monday morning. We still didn't have the money. And Monday morning, about mid-morning, a local attorney called me to his office and gave me a check for $29,000 from an anonymous donor who didn't know anything about our needs. And I call it God wears his own watch, because it seemed like he was late right then. But he waited until I responded to the lack, and then he showed what he already had already planned and all set out to do. That was a huge turning point for me. That was a great time when I realized I didn't have to be spiritual enough to lead the ministry. I just had to follow God the best way I could.
Amazing. To describe your personal relationship with the Lord Jesus, what kind of regular practices does it involve?
Leaders are readers, not just general books, but also readers of the Bible. And I'm distressed when I did a survey of our staff a couple of years ago and found out that many of our staff members have never read the Bible all the way through. I read the scriptures through on an average probably of every 18 months to 20 months and have since I was a teenager. On a typical day of devotions, I'll spend between 20 and 40 minutes depending on the time that I make, but I need to do that first thing. If I do something else first, maybe a breakfast meeting or something, I find it really hard to concentrate on my time with the Lord after that. I really love food, and in fact, I can be grouchy if I miss even one meal. Some of the very best times I've had with God have been times of prayer and fasting, and I've sometimes gone without food for 2 or 3 days or even for a week or longer, at special times of stress or times of seeking the Lord. And God has shown himself to me in those times just more than I could have ever hoped or thought.
Mm. Thank you for describing that. What are your major continuing passions, and how do you describe your life's mission?
I continue, of course, to work at Miracle Hill, and I lead the ministry there. But at this stage of my life, my mission statement is to lead and mentor those who will lead and mentor others. I get my greatest fulfillment out of teaching, out of mentoring, out of discipling. I do a limited amount of counseling, of writing. I really enjoy investing in the lives of those who are serving our clients or those who are ministering in other places, and I do enjoy the time that I invest directly in the lives of our clients.
So the teaching you refer to is within the Miracle Hill community?
Both and. I do premarital counseling both inside and outside of the ministry. I get to teach the ladies at the Renewal Program, which is our women's drug addiction recovery program, once a month, and that's probably my favorite time of teaching. I speak in the chapel at the Men's Rescue Mission once a month. I, of course, lead staff meetings and often do trainings for our staff, but I also mentor people outside the ministry as well.
After our last short break, we'll hear about your work today and your second visitor and what you'll put in the last chapter of your book.
Hello, I'm Chris Doyle, president of American Leprosy Mission. I want to tell you the story of a young man from Angola that suffered from one of the most frightening diseases known to man, leprosy. Carlos came from a poor family in the city of Huambo. After completing high school, he became a school teacher and enjoyed that work for 12 years. Then suddenly he began to feel terrible pain in his legs, and nodules began to appear on his face and ears, making him look terrible. First, he spent a lot of money on traditional treatments and also in the hospitals of the Huambo area. However, the disease continued to worsen. It was then that a friend told him to go to the Kalakembe Hospital, and so he did. When the doctors saw him, they told him the devastating news. He had leprosy. He broke down and cried bitterly. But thankfully, the nurses and doctors cheered him up and told him that he needed to have faith in the great physician, the Lord Jesus Christ, because he cures us on the inside and the outside. Carlos stayed at the hospital for 5 years and was finally discharged as a cured patient. His testimony is that he was cured not only in his body, but in his soul. Even though he was baptized as a child, he was far from God. As he was following the treatment, he started to study the Bible. As a result of the Bible study, God transformed his life. He was baptized in the chapel just outside the hospital in the leprosy village. In his own words, Carlos says, "I am happy because Jesus Christ lives in me and also in my family. And I wish to express thanks to all who have, through love and sacrifice, contributed to our having this opportunity as leprosy patients to find a cure in our bodies and in our souls." Through the generous gifts of people like you, Carlos and many others can experience a defining moment in their lives. But there are many others in the world suffering from leprosy. They need your help. Leprosy strikes a new victim every 2 minutes. Please call us at 1-800-LEPROSY or go to our website at leprosy.org. Give a gift today and be a part of a defining moment in the life of a child with leprosy. Please call today, and thanks for caring.
Welcome back to Defining Moments. We're talking with Reed Lehman, President and CEO of Miracle Hill Ministries in Greenville, South Carolina. Now, tell us more about your work at Miracle Hill and some of the main things that are going on there.
Well, I mentioned that we care for about 400 men, women, and children per night, but we're in the midst of an expansion to take us to 600 men, women, and children per night. We have purchased the monastery of Poor Clare from the nuns of Poor Clare who moved to a new location, and that will add 80 beds, which we'll use for our men's addiction recovery program. That should be open in February. And when the men move out of the Greenville Rescue Mission, or at least that part of the program moves out of there, we'll have 60 additional emergency care beds for men. Our women's addiction recovery program has moved to the Rosewood facilities on Rutherford Road, and that has expanded that program from about 14 beds to about 20, giving us more beds at Shepherd's Gate for emergency care. We're also building a subdivision for transitional housing in West Greenville, as well as acquiring some standalone houses in various locations, so that when people finish our programs and get a job, they can move into an affordable place. So often when you leave a shelter like Miracle Hill can provide, and the only place you can afford is a cheap motel, and at 2 in the morning someone's knocking on your door offering you the very temptations that you just recently escaped.
Mm.
That transitional housing is critical for us.
I can understand that. So what are the target dates for these expansions? When will you get to the 600, do you think?
I think we should be at the 600 in about 12 to 14 months. And in the middle of a recession, that probably isn't the smartest business decision we've ever made. But we do think God is calling us into it, and he's going to supply our need.
Well, I'm sure he will. And what about, how do you spend your time there? What are your major activities in your daily work?
Probably a third of my time is spent fundraising, and calling on donors, spending time with donors, working on plans for fundraising. I represent us in public forums. I sometimes speak in supporting churches or civic clubs. Maybe a third of my time is spent in staff meetings and working with our staff to sort of plan the future or to look back over what we're accomplishing. And then about a third of my time is spent planning, thinking, sometimes writing, and planning for future presentations.
How many direct reports do you have?
I have four. Our Director of Ministries, Ken Kelly, our Chief Financial Officer, Bruce Avishevsky, Frankie Powell, our Director of Development, and then Annette Lehman is my assistant, and she also happens to be a cousin.
Do you consider it a highly demanding job? Do you spend a lot of time at it?
On a normal week, I'll probably spend 50 to 55 hours on work-related things. Quite often, the financial pressures can get pretty demanding. When you're a faith ministry and your weekly payroll is $70,000 a week, just missing a week or two can take you pretty far behind quickly. But what I find is that the closer I am with God, the less the pressure affects me. When I'm cheating on my devotions or if there's sin in my life, I sometimes just feel completely overwhelmed and defeated. When I'm prayed up and I'm spending quality time with God, it doesn't matter what's going on at work. I'm just fine.
Well, I bet you've seen a lot of miracles in your years there. Can you tell us about another one?
Many of the ones I share relate to God's providing financially at critical times. I'd like to talk about one that happened in 2002. as we were going through a very difficult time financially. We needed about $400,000 to be current with day-to-day obligations. We had grown rapidly over the past 3 years, and we were just trying to get to equilibrium with our operating costs and go back to stability. And I promised our staff we would not grow that year. And then there was a big scandal in Spartanburg. The newspaper there was printing stories, front page above the fold, about some misdealings that were going on at the rescue mission. The leadership there resigned. The board there called us and asked if we would take over the ministry there. And it was a ministry that I had had on my heart for some time. I knew that if we didn't step in, the mission would probably close and there would be nowhere for homeless people to go. But I knew that if we took it over and God wasn't in it, it could sink us overall. The operating costs there were about $30,000 a month, and because of the scandal, the income had fallen to about $6,000 a month. And so we had a board meeting, a special call board meeting, to decide whether or not to accept it, and Barbara had already told me not to do it. She knew the pressure I was under, and before the board meeting, I spent a week in prayer and fasting, and I had two requests of God during that week. The first request was, Lord, help me not to care, because I wanted it so bad I could taste it. And so I didn't want to manipulate the board into their decision. And I said, help me not to have a preference about which way to go. And the second request was, Lord, would you make the board unanimously for it or against it, so that I would hear you speak clearly. By the time the board met, I truly didn't care. And because Barbara had seen me seeking the Lord, she had withdrawn her request. As the board began talking, it was clear they were not going to do it. They have a good business sense about them, and they're conservative. And they began talking and debating, and about 45 minutes in, they asked me what I thought we should do. And I said, well, I'm counting on God to tell me through you. I have a little bit of inkling that maybe we should do it, but nothing strong enough that I can tell you we should do it. And then I shut up again. And they kept talking, and half an hour later, they voted unanimously that God wanted us to take on this new responsibility. And I drove home that night just rejoicing that God had spoken. The next day, we got a call from the Bank of America Trust Department telling us of a trust that had been set in place 15 years ago, but it was only paying out now because of a recent death of the last beneficiary. And we received 2 months later $929,000, the largest gift in our history. Had we known about that gift, the decision would have been easy. But God waited till after we made our decision before showing us what he already had for us.
My, my. God wears his own watch.
He does.
What a wonderful title for your book. Who are the most significant people in your life? Say two or three.
Well, first is Barbara, my wife and my best friend. Being married to her has helped me understand more than almost anything else what it means to live a Christian life. And I'm not saying that because it's been difficult. It has been difficult because I'm a difficult learner, and it took me a while to learn how to love her. But she truly is God's greatest gift to me. And my sons probably are the second most significant people in my life, and I cherish the relationship I have with them. A person who stepped into my father's role after my father died was a guy named F.A. Lawton, and he's been dead now for several years. But he was Dad's best friend, and he was such a father figure for me between 85 and about 2000. And then today I have a friend named Lang Ligon, and he's an emeritus member of our board. He's in his 80s. I want to be like him when I grow up. He's such a gentle spirit. He's so kind to the people around him. He lives out what it's like to walk with God in old age, and he's just a great blessing to me.
Great. Are there any avocations that you've continued?
Well, I jog to release tension and so that I can sleep after times when things are tense or trying. I took up cycling a few years ago after Miracle Hill started a fundraising challenge called the Miracle Hill Cycling Challenge. I enjoy reading, writing, and occasionally snow skiing.
Snow skiing. Where do you go to ski?
A friend of our family's has a condo out in Colorado, and occasionally, maybe once every year or two, we get to fly out there and spend a weekend with him.
Oh, great. I grew up in the Rocky Mountains, so that touches mine.
I could live there. I love that. I love that territory.
How about one more defining moment, if you have one?
Oh, I mentioned earlier that my son and I went to be homeless when he was 13. Matt and I 1993, went to Wilmington, North Carolina, and lived on the streets of Wilmington for 5 days. Andy and I went to Savannah, Georgia in 1995 and lived on the streets there for 5 days. My goal was to show them that God would answer our prayers and meet our needs personally. And he did that. He answered every prayer that we prayed, but it also was the best thing I've ever done with my sons. It brought us close together like nothing that we've ever done before. And in fact, when Matt and I went, we couldn't stand each other, and he didn't want to go. But by the end of that 5 days, we were closer than we'd ever been.
How did you set that up? Did you take no money?
We took only the clothes that we were wearing. We wore old paint-covered clothes, and I hadn't shaved in a couple of weeks, and wore glasses with a safety pin. And all I had was a driver's license and a letter that identified me as the father of this boy that was with me, because I didn't want someone to think I'd kidnapped him. But we had no toilet articles, no toothpaste, no money, no credit cards, no ways to sustain ourselves. And I picked towns I knew nothing about so that I didn't already go to the town knowing of a fallback place or somewhere we could be cared for.
And did you find things like Miracle Hills Rescue Mission there?
I found a rescue mission in each place, and neither would care for a father with a child. But it turned out in each location, there was a Salvation Army, and they would. So I ended up staying at the Salvation Army, and my story was that my son and I are temporarily separated from our family, and that we should be able to rejoin our family in about 5 days. So we were looking for a bridge time, a place to stay.
Mm. An amazing thing to do. I don't know anyone who's ever told me they've done that. But I suppose, given your orientation of your career, it was just such a natural thing to do, wasn't it?
Well, it was sort of a natural thing. I've been searching for several years for something to do that would show them God answering prayer in that way. And I assured my wife that it was completely safe because I knew all about homelessness. But I left her a letter in the sock drawer that said, "Dear Barbara, if you find this letter, I'm really sorry about what must have happened." For the second trip, before Andy and I left, she was a little bit more assertive, and she grabbed me by the collar and pulled me up close, and she said, "Listen, you come home without my son, and there's going to be some real problems in our relationship. Do you understand me?"
Well, I'm glad you didn't have to face that. Who will be your second visitor from the past?
Dietrich Bonhoeffer, a Lutheran German pastor during World War II. His book, The Cost of Discipleship, is a classic, and I recommend it for every Christian. But by the end of it, within a couple of short years, he was executed as a traitor for plotting against the life of Adolf Hitler. I would love to just hear about his experiences in seeking and following God and the thought process that led him both from that amazing book to the way that he ended his life.
And was he justly accused of that?
I think that he actually was planning to help assassinate Adolf Hitler, yes.
Hmm. That's what everybody seems to think. I wondered what your opinion was. Well, your book will have a last chapter, and in it you can tell us about your hopes for the future or things you would most like your descendants or successors to hear or any other final words. What will be the most important item in that last chapter?
Well, I guess if a last chapter is a way of sort of summing your life or giving your last words, there's two thoughts I'd like to share. One is that in ministry, God is willing for us to do ministry as we like. Now, I don't mean contrary to his word or contrary to the things that he's already told us, but I mean what I've seen at Miracle Hill is when we wanted to do ministry with no knowledge and primitive and almost broke, he was perfectly willing for us to do ministry, and we did a lot of good ministry. When we felt like God was calling us to do it with nicer facilities and with a predictable salary structure and paying the staff every week, he was perfectly willing to do it that way. So often he allows his work to be constrained by the way we perceive it. And so often we constrain ourselves by having way too small a vision for what he would like to do through us. Secondly, whether you're in ministry or not, look around you. What are the things that God cares about? What are the people God cares about? And whether you're in Christian ministry or what in work we call secular, which is just sort of the natural business, the business environment, why not begin investing your life in situations or lives that you know God cares about? Get busy representing him in that way and see how he'll use you.
It's a powerful way to live. Are there any other final thoughts you'd like to leave our audience with?
Well, as you know, Miracle Hill Ministry is a ministry to the poor, and why should you care about the poor? Isn't that a specialized ministry to those who are called to it? Ezekiel 16, chapter 49 says, "This was the sin of the city of Sodom. She and her daughters, the cities around her, were arrogant, overfed, and unconcerned. They did not help the poor and needy." I'm sure you believe, you know of a different reason why Sodom was destroyed, and I know that that was a part of it. But God's judgment about Sodom was they were tied up in their own affairs, and they didn't reach out to the people in need around them. Proverbs chapter 29, verse 7 says, "The righteous considereth the cause of the poor, but the wicked regardeth not to know it." There are so many ministries serving the poor. There's Miracle Hill. There's the Salvation Army. There's Piedmont Women's Center is protecting the lives of the unborn. Salvation Army Boys and Girls Club. I'm not saying that God is calling you to serve with Miracle Hill, but in whatever environment you're in, God is calling you to reach out to those in need, and I challenge you to do so.
Every church ought to take that to heart, and I hope that they will in supporting you and in reaching out on their own to those who are in need. Reed Lehman, thanks again for sharing your life with us. It's been enlightening and most inspiring. We're very glad you've devoted your life to serving the needy and poor in Jesus' name, and we pray that He'll continue to bless you and prosper Miracle Hill, and we appreciate your work so much. And thank you again for your time.
Thanks, Bob.
And to all our listeners, you can hear this and past programs at DefiningMomentsRadio.com. Please tell others about that. There you can also suggest someone to be interviewed, and please send us your comments about the program. That's DefiningMomentsRadio.com. Thank you very much for joining us today. Please make a defining moment in the life of someone with leprosy by making that call or visiting leprosy.org.
Next week's guest at Scribbler's Den will be Dr. Brent Nelson, chairman of the Political Science Department at Furman University. So tune to Christian Talk 660 at 2 p.m. next Sunday for his defining moment. Defining Moments is a production of Amici Media in conjunction with Altitude Audio. To suggest a person to be interviewed, email a brief description to subject@definingmomentsradio.com.
When my mother and father saw that I had leprosy, they said, "You have to leave our home. You have a terrible disease, and if you don't leave, many others will get sick."
This is Shamily Bika. She is 12 years old. She knows that what leprosy has done to others, it can also do to her. Leprosy begins by destroying the sense of touch in the limbs. Without feeling, a person easily injures their hands and feet. Paralyzing deformities often appear. As the years go by, sunken noses further deform the face. Shamily is beginning the fight of her life.
I was very young when I got leprosy, so I know how terrible it is. Look at my hands. Look at my face. If I could wish for anything, it would be that no child would ever suffer this, that every child will be cured of leprosy. That is my prayer.
Leprosy still strikes over 500,000 people a year, many of them children. The cure for leprosy is 3 little pills taken for 6 months or longer until the leprosy bacilli are destroyed. The average cost to cure a person of leprosy is only $20 a month for 1 year, or $240. But most people with leprosy, like Shamily, live in poverty. They simply can't afford the cure. Thousands hope to receive the cure before leprosy destroys their faces, hands, and feet. That's why your help now is so important. Call now and say you'll provide the cure for a person like Shamily. Call American Leprosy Missions at 1-800-543-3131. Your gift is tax deductible. Please call now, 1-800-543-3131.